In the coming week, China convenes its annual legislative session. Pope Francis travels to Iraq amid COVID-19 and security concerns, and International Women's Day is celebrated across the globe. It's March 4th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, in the coming week, China's National People's Congress and a body known as the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference are set to meet in tandem. The two meetings are usually attended by more than 5,000 delegates from across the country. They look to set up the coming year in the country in terms of policies domestic and abroad. But Jim, could you give us a sense of the background of what's known as the annual two sessions?
Certainly, Bob. The CPPCC is actually the political advisory body to the NPC. Sorry for these inelegant acronyms. Now, the CPPCC actually opened today. The NPC is going to open tomorrow. As you note, these sessions run in tandem. And I should emphasize, they're largely ceremonial. They're meant to showcase China's policy priorities. And while they typically last 2 weeks, because of COVID, they're just going to last for 1 week this year. Now, as the two sessions kick off, I would describe the mood as upbeat. I think the sense in Beijing is, as I saw it recently phrased, the East is rising and the West is declining. Or if you want to make it more pointed, we're winning, you're losing. You can understand why Chinese officials feel this way. They look around and say, we may have been the first hit by COVID, but we pretty much licked it. We had the best performing major economy in 2020. If you look out, the United States, Europe did very badly. And not surprisingly, in the run-up to the two sessions, we're seeing a lot of praise in the Chinese state media for Xi Jinping's stellar leadership of a rising China. So what can we expect in the meeting itself? I think actually five things. One is you're going to see a release of China's 14th five-year plan. It's expected to focus on self-reliance. I think a big part of that is going to be about becoming more reliant or self-reliant in terms of technology, particularly semiconductors and the chips that go into the modern economy. They really want to cut dependence on the West.
And we should note that they had this China 2025 policy too, right?
Well, we're going to get to that in a second because every 5 years it gets up updated, not surprisingly. But the second thing is the annual report for 2021. Typically, this is where they announce a growth target for the economy. The betting money that is this year, we're not going to get a growth target, but you'll get a bunch of targets for things like inflation, jobs, and the like. And these are things that people who study economics and financial flows are paying a lot of attention to. Third thing, I think, Bob, is what you alluded to, a vision for the future. I think we're due now to get the vision for 2035. In essence, a vision of how the next 15 years are going to unfold. Fourth, I think we could see possible revisions to Hong Kong's electoral system. And let's put it this way, I suspect any, quote, reforms are going to be aimed at crushing the democracy movement in Hong Kong. I'll note that, again, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference actually kicked off this morning, and the chairman of that advisory body said that, in his view, only pro-China patriots should be able to hold elected office in Hong Kong. I think the fifth issue that's going to come up is China's population. And if you look at China's demography, we're looking at a population that is almost certainly going to decrease over the next several decades. I've seen projections suggesting that China's population, if trends continue, will only be about 700 million people by 2100, down from a current population of about 1.3 to 1.4 billion people. So one of the big talks is going to be about what China might do to sort of reverse the decline in the birth rate. Numbers just came out this week, which suggest that China's birth rate is the lowest it's been since, I think, the late 1950s.
So that last part is particularly intriguing, Jim, because it's the part where sort of the victory lap feels like it slows down a bit, given the pretty sober numbers about demography, but also what that means for the older population in China, you know, the ability for Chinese society to support a very large older population. The one-child policy has been, it's been noted repeatedly, helped create this problem. So that will be interesting to see how sort of candid Chinese officials are on that front. But I also was wondering whether, to the extent you think they will address public health issues, the aftermath of coronavirus, and sort of what kind of gestures, if anything, they'll make in terms of the public health and their role in public health.
Well, I would expect, given what we've seen in the run-up to the two sessions, Bob, is that the message on health is going to be, we're doing a great job. Look at how we've licked COVID-19, put it in its place. Compare us, for example, to the United United States, which has a much higher death rate. So I think for the Chinese government talking about global health, they're going to spin it in a positive way. But there certainly are dark clouds on the horizon, things that worry the Chinese. Two of them we've already mentioned. One is population. It's clear that China is going to be the first country to become old before it gets rich, and that will put a lot of stress on its social safety net, which is really underdeveloped. Second cloud on the horizon, obviously, is China's dependence on the United States and the West for a lot of technology, particularly in semiconductors. That is an advantage that the United States recognizes. The Biden administration, like the Trump administration, intends to do what he can to preserve that advantage and sort of prevent China from closing the gap. But there are two other clouds on the horizons I would flag for you, Bob. One is the security services. Very interesting. Late last month, the Communist Party announced the start of a long-expected purge of the 3 million members of its security forces. These are the police, the secret police, prison officials, the judiciary. And in announcing the campaign, the Communist Party has used some rather interesting language saying that this effort is about, let me quote them here, turning the knife blade inward to gouge out those deemed to be corrupt or insufficiently loyal to the party and its leader. So we'll have to see how that campaign goes, what it turns up, and as is always the case in a closed political system like this, what divisions it might create at the top as people see the potential that their faction may be being hurt by this campaign. The other cloud on the horizon is a financial bubble. China's top banking regulator warned this week about the risk of bubbles across the international financial system, but also in China's own real estate markets, as we saw back in 2008, 2009. When bubbles pop, they can pop in a way that creates a tremendous amount of havoc. So I think the Chinese are really worried about that because that's obviously one potential stumbling block for their vision of China emerging as not just an equal to the United States, but a country that surpasses the United States.
So we're looking at sort of the age-old kind of gathering of a communist government getting together, a very powerful leader that one will expect to face some fawning attention, but also, as you say, Jim, some very real problems that'll be interesting to see how well they address in this meeting.
Right, Bob. And again, this is ceremonial. The focus is going to be on the successes. It's not going to be on the failures. And in fact, I don't imagine that the F word is going to be used unless it's used with respect to people who have been pushed out of the party already.
Understood.
Bob, let's switch gears and let's turn our attention to the trip that Pope Francis will be making to Iraq, actually starting tomorrow. Despite the threats posed by COVID-19 and despite threats of heightened security concerns in the region, the Pope still intends to go to Iraq. Can you tell us what the Pope is hoping to accomplish on this trip, Bob?
Sure, Jim. There are a lot of questions still circling around this trip. The objectives, which I'll get into in a second, seem pretty straightforward. But the timing is raising a lot of concern, as you indicated. It's taking place while Iraq is dealing with another nasty turn of the coronavirus, which includes, by the way, the Vatican envoy to Iraq having to self-quarantine out of precaution that he has the coronavirus. But the Pope has been vaccinated. His whole entourage, I believe, has been vaccinated. They are promising to hold events in a much more sort of safe, smaller set of venues. Papal trips tend to be vast crowd gatherings with, you know, everything from large Catholic masses to other big ecumenical gatherings. They'll be smaller, but there's a fairly ambitious agenda here, Jim, going on. So I'll go through the agenda a little bit and then talk about what the Pope is trying to address here. It's worth noting Iraq has one of the oldest Christian and what's known as an Eastern Rite Catholic followings in the world. And so the Pope will be making visits to several places that date back to the earliest days of Christendom, really. And he will also be going to visit Ur in southern Iraq, which is where the sort of the patriarch of three major faiths, Abraham, was said to be born. That the three major faiths being Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But first, the Pope arrives in Baghdad. He meets the prime minister at the airport. He will go to the presidential palace. He goes the very next day to what looks to be one of the most closely watched meetings of the visit, which is a meeting with Ayatollah Ali Sistani in Najaf, just south of Baghdad. Sistani is considered one of the most revered, if not the most revered, figures in Shia Islam. He doesn't travel from Najaf. He's 90 years old. He carries tremendous credibility and has spoken up in several junctures since the ouster of Saddam Hussein in 2003 to weigh in on matters involving Iraqi stability and Iraqi voting. He's weighed in on the need to vote, for example. And so that visit in particular is very interesting. The Pope has wanted to meet Sistani for a while. And after a great deal of negotiation, apparently it's going to happen. Sistani's spokesmen have said that he's actually going to stand up to greet the pontiff, which is something that the Ayatollah does not typically do. And then they will talk for something like 40 minutes. There's speculation about whether or not they would sign some sort of joint statement. It's very unclear whether that's going to happen. But just the fact of this meeting between two major faith leaders is going to be very interesting to watch and what sort of message is conveyed. The Pope is also trying to send what his office in the Vatican is calling a message of love to Iraq, certainly an embattled people, whether it's the endless sort of cycle of terrorism and violence and other problems, maybe more mundane on the economic front that they've faced, certainly in the last couple of decades. And obviously before that, under Saddam Hussein, the Pope is going to go to the, after visiting Ali Sistani in Najaf, he's going to go to the north, to Erbil, to Mosul, to Karakosh. And he's going to be visiting places, especially Mosul, where the Islamic State, during its few years of terror, ousted and desecrated Catholic, Eastern Catholic shrines and worship sites. He's going to meet with displaced communities in Erbil. And again, a message of solidarity. He's trying to convey to this old community of Christians that the Pope recognizes them and is there to help support them. Vatican has already provided some money to restore some of their buildings and shrines. And then he wraps it up on Monday with a farewell ceremony at Baghdad's airport. So it's a tight visit under very unusual, difficult, to say the least, circumstances. But I think he's trying to accomplish a lot. I think the Pope himself at 84 years old might see this as maybe a window that he can do this. But again, the timing of the trip is raising questions.
Bob, the security precautions for this trip must be enormous. Who actually is going to be protecting the Pope?
That's a really good question. I think you have host country usually plays a very big role, and I think that's going to be the case from what I've seen in the preparations for his arrival. While I just gave a bunch of information about his itinerary, actually a lot of specifics are not being released, but I think Iraqis will notice through various close downs of various major traffic arteries and neighborhoods and so forth that the government security forces are going to be in charge of that. I think you have around Ayatollah Sistani, he's got his own security sort of cohort in addition to whatever government security forces there are. And the same thing in the Kurdish region in the north in Erbil, one would imagine the same thing. The north is particularly fraught, I think, because this trip is happening at a time in which there have been multiple rocket attacks against U.S. positions near Erbil. There's a base where there's something like 2,500 U.S. troops. The U.S. is blaming Iranian-backed militia groups, either based in Syria or in Iraq. And that's going to be very interesting to watch. It could still be something that might affect the pace of this trip, given that there was just a recent reprisal attack just a couple of days ago.
But it's not the case that the United States, for example, is responsible in any way for the Pope's security.
I don't believe so, Jim. I have not seen anything to that effect, although I would think in the north, the trip to the Erbil region where there is such a large base, there will certainly be a great deal of communication between U.S. and Iraqi forces and any sort of other coalition forces in the area that's supporting the mission, which is in that part of the country, it's still a sort of an anti-ISIS, anti-terrorism mission.
And this is the Kurdish portion of Iraq.
That is the Kurdish portion of Iraq, right, which is still quite autonomous. They actually had a vote on independence a couple of years ago that did not have any practical effect. But the Kurdish region is quite autonomous. And they have, in addition to a sort of an umbrella government support, they have their own forces there and have been traditionally quite effective. You raise a good question, Jim. I think the security, even more than COVID, there's some concerns about a super spreader event maybe taking place. And while that's not to be dismissed, I think Iraq is one of these places where you just have had some stunning terror attacks, even in recent years. And when you deal with questions like, sectarian violence and a figure like the Pope, I think you can't dismiss that, unfortunately. So it's going to be really closely watched.
And we've seen plenty of evidence over the last couple of decades to realize that the Iraqi security services are not necessarily reliable.
Yeah. Again, it does get to portions of the country where you might have Shia militias that might have some undue influence that can't be ruled out. Again, the fact that the Pope is coming as a gesture of peace here might carry some sway. You have the ISIS elements, which are Sunni Muslim, that are still trying to, maintain some sort of foothold in parts of Iraq's fringes, and their ability to be effective and actually establish for a period of time a foothold in Mosul and nearby areas was attributable at the time to really weak, lax Iraqi security. It must be said that when you had Shia militias, and some of them were Iranian-backed, sort of fighting back, you had Kurds fighting back, and then you had the U.S. galvanizing them, that ended up being, an effective mix that ousted the Islamic State. But it is an area of concern, Jim. And so it's another reason why there's a lot of anxiety, I would say, in some places around this trip.
Well, I hope at the end, all this anxiety proves misplaced.
It would be good to see in the midst of everything going on. I mean, this is the first papal trip since the pandemic hit. And I think that's another gesture that can't be sort of underrepresented. I think the Pope is trying to make a gesture about an ecumenical move towards unifying religions, even of different, you know, confessions and so forth. You know, even going to what's called the Chaldean Catholic Church, which is makes up just maybe a few hundred thousand in Iraq, is seen as very important within Christianity. But then also speaking to Muslim leaders has been a big part of the Pope's mission since he became Pope in 2013. And so I think he sees this as really important and no time like the present to continue to press that forward. Jim, as many listeners know, March is Women's History Month, and this coming Monday, March the 8th, is International Women's Day. So Jim, falling as it does amidst the pandemic, can you talk a little bit about the significance of the day as well as falling in the time of the COVID pandemic?
Sure, Bob. Perhaps where we should start is how we came to have International Women's Day. It was first recognized back in 1975 by the United Nations, and then 2 years later, the UN General Assembly formally designated March 8th every year is International Women's Day. Each year they have a theme, and this year's theme is Choose to Challenge. And the official proclamation reads, "We can all choose to challenge and call out gender bias and inequality. We can all choose to seek out and celebrate women's achievements. Collectively, we can all help create an inclusive world." Now, when we celebrate International Women's Day on Monday, I think we can tell both a good story and a sad story. The good story, particularly here in the United States, is that we are seeing further evidence of women's empowerment. Obviously, we had elections last fall here in the United States. Kamala Harris selected vice president. She's the first woman to hold the position. I will note that beyond the White House, women increased their representation in the United States Congress. This Congress, the 117th Congress, has the largest percentage of women holding office of any Congress in American history. About 27% of the seats in Congress are held by women. That's up from 24% in the 116th Congress. And I will note that there are women on both sides of the aisle. There are more women who are Democrats in Congress than there are Republican women in Congress. I will also note, obviously, that President Biden, in selecting his cabinet and staffing his administration, has made an effort to achieve gender balance with his appointments. Indeed, Biden is the first president to nominate a gender-balanced cabinet. He nominated 12 women to cabinet and cabinet level positions. And if they are all confirmed, that would be a record. President Biden has also created a gender policy council to help implement his pledge to prioritize gender equity issues across the U.S. government. So from that vantage point, some significant things have happened. That's the good news. But on the sad news side, it's pretty clear that COVID-19 has had a disproportionate impact on women. Let me just cite a couple of statistics, Bob. Women account for about 39% of global employment, but they make up about 54% of global pandemic-related losses. There are estimates now that as many as 11 million girls may not return to school after the pandemic. We're seeing in the United States that almost 2.5 million women have left the workforce compared to just 1.8 million men. And one of the other factors relying here is even with women who remain in the workforce, the burden of caring for children, for family, has for cultural reasons fallen disproportionately on them, making their lives all the harder. I think even more broadly, people who have worked in the area of empowering women, girls' education, women's employment around the world are really worried that COVID-19 is going to set back many of the gains that have made over the last decade or so. And it will take us quite a while to dig out from under the impact of COVID-19.
I would note for our listeners that our sister podcast, President's Inbox, you talked to Rachel Fogelstein about International Women's Day, in particular about impact of COVID. She made the interesting point about countries in which women are in leadership or hold the top leadership roles having a pretty strong track record in their response to COVID so far. But I recommend people listen to the entire podcast. But I thought that point seemed seems to be a very interesting one to continue to follow, whether you're looking at New Zealand, for instance, or some of the other countries that have notched some very strong track records. Women have been kind of from the get-go acting swiftly on this for the most part.
That was one of many interesting points that Rachel made when we sat down to talk about these issues, Bob. The other thing I thought was very interesting is that data shows that domestic violence has increased substantially, not just in the United States, but around the world as a result of COVID-19. A lot of it having to do with people being locked down and it being harder in many ways to detect domestic violence because people aren't leaving their homes where the consequences of domestic violence might be noticed, a black eye or something like that. So that's something like really important to keep an eye on.
It's, as you say, there's a great deal of achievement to note on this day when you usually do sort of look at achievements across the board, but it's hard to get past the disproportionate burden on women. And so I think we all continue to have lessons to draw on from this day and as well as the pandemic, Jim.
And obviously the big wild card in all this, Bob, is how quickly national economies and the global economy respond or rebound from COVID-19. If we have a rapid return to a more normal economy, we can catch up and close the gap and perhaps come out ahead in terms of women's empowerment and employment. However, if we end up with a protracted period of sluggish economic growth or recession, obviously it's going to set back all of the gains over the last couple of decades for quite some time. But Bob, we've now reached the point in the podcast where we discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected Nicolas Sarkozy found guilty. Can you tell us a bit about why former French President Sarkozy is going to jail?
Jim, sure. Sarkozy, who was president from 2007 to about 2012, was found guilty of offering a plum job in Monaco to a judge in exchange for inside information into an inquiry on his campaign finances. And it makes him the first president in what is said to be modern France to be found guilty of corruption in office in this way. There were charges brought against former President Jacques Chirac related to his time as Paris mayor, but they were not corruption charges that he was found guilty of. Sarkozy then sort of distinguishes himself in this way, although he's challenging the ruling, he's dismissed them. His lawyer called it extremely severe and totally unfounded and so forth. But even if he's able to successfully appeal, it does seem like with this and other cases that are pending against him that involve corruption of various sorts, that it's a blow to Sarkozy's chances that had been floated of possibly running for the country's next presidential election. He is a figure that still has a lot of support on sort of the French right, but not clear the extent to which that support will carry him through this particular incident, Jim.
So if the legal process winds on and Sarkozy does not win his appeals, what happens? Does he go to prison? How does the French penal system treat a former president of the Republic?
Well, it's already been indicated that although he was given a 3-year jail term, two of those were suspended, and he instead is due to serve a 1-year sentence at home wearing an electronic bracelet to confirm that he is in fact serving time at home. So again, if he ultimately is unsuccessful, he's facing a year at home with electronic surveillance. So not an onerous burden necessarily.
So it's not like in the old days where they send people to Devil's Island.
We're not talking Devil's Island, Jim. We're not talking Elba or anything like that. But it is it's still quite a fall for someone who was so powerful, someone who had kind of tried to use his power in all sorts of ways, in both domestic and foreign policy. People may recall even his attempts to achieve sort of common cause with Angela Merkel. They were known as Merkozy for a while because of sort of the way they were kind of working in tandem on some continental issues back in the day. However, again, in terms of someone trying to mount a political comeback, this is seen, again, even if he is successful in countering the court ruling, that it seemed like it's a real blow to his chance for a 2022 presidential run.
If the conviction stands, would he be eligible to run or is he disqualified for being on the ballot?
I believe the latter, Jim. The other thing I would point to, as many reports are saying, is that he still has several other cases that need to get processed and could get processed before the election, including allegations that he received millions of euros from former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi for his 2007 election campaign. That's a charge that has kind of dogged him for a number of years. And there are other legal cases that are pending as well involving corruption of various sorts. So whether or not this particular one could torpedo him, regardless of the ultimate outcome, I'm not clear on, but I do know he's facing other ones that are sort of tarnishing him continuously.
Does Sarkozy's legal problems create any advantages or benefits for other political parties or leaders in France?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because, you know, his successor as head of the Republicans in France was François Fillon, but he ended up having to bow out of his race in 2016 after facing his own charges of fraud. It created an opening for Emmanuel Macron, who was going to run again, who essentially created a party out of whole cloth to run and was successful. So politics are flexible enough. The political infrastructure in France is, in a way involving political parties, is flexible enough that this can happen. So it's not to be ruled out. It's not clear whether the Republicans would have enough support to be able to mount a successful nationwide campaign. But who knows whether there's like a center-right candidate who emerges with his own stitched-together coalition, Jim. So it's going to bear watching, definitely.
Well, obviously, Macron has his own problems, and Madame Le Pen remains a significant force in French politics. So we'll see how it all unfolds.
Yeah, and one still doesn't know, you know, what sort of the final moments of this pandemic are going to yield and the impact that that's going to have. It's already created all sorts of stresses across the democratic spectrum, as we've seen already.
Certainly true, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Japan marks the 10th anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. The first anniversary of the World Health Organization declaring COVID-19 a pandemic is remembered. And in the sporting realm, the annual Iditarod dog sledge race begins in Alaska.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.